You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest, Jeremy Courtney, is founder and CEO of Preemptive Love, a relief and job creation community working to end war. Jeremy speaks globally on the integration of activism, spirituality, leadership, and service. His work has been covered by CNN, BBC, Al Jazeera, and the New York Times. He lives in Iraq with his family. Jeremy, welcome back to Seminary Dropout.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
We were talking a little bit before we started recording. You're on a tour right now promoting the new book and movie, both titled Love Anyway. How's the tour going?
Yeah, it's amazing. The book and the film are very different. So it's not like one is a substitute for the other, but it's just been cool to use them as tools to kind of get into the room with people. I've spent a fair amount of the last couple of years when I come back from Iraq or Syria or, you know, whatever, I work in Mexico. And if I'm going to be in the States, it's often centered around a big conference, so or a big church gathering or something. So I've been spending maybe too much of my relative time in the last 2 years on big stages in front of thousands of people, and it's been amazing to go back to the start in a lot of ways and get into small living rooms, small event spaces with 30 people, 50 people, 10 people, and just watch the film together and then enter into an hour-long, robust conversation, you know, about all the things that are tearing us apart and how we together can help heal that.
I want to talk a little bit about just the nature of the film and the book as well. You know, we're like living in a time where everybody kind of has an opinion about the right way to do relief work and social work, like, you know, lowercase social work. One of the things that struck me as I was watching the film and reading the book is you guys are so transparent, and you've kind of always operated this way, so transparent. And I wonder if there was some fear about having that out there for people to kind of pick apart and critique and criticize.
Yeah, a lot of, I've had a lot of concerns about it, honestly. And some of that may just be common stuff to all of us that we fear we always are filtering our lives. And in the social media age, maybe we have an occasion to broadcast certain things, but that just leads to a curation that we're excluding other things. But in addition to the anxieties and fears that might be common to all of us to be in the public eye or have our laundry aired out, I think part of my anxiety or fears do relate to my starting point. And my starting point in many ways was as an undercover, covert Christian missionary, which inculcated into me, nurtured a sense of fear by design. I mean, when you are set up to lie to governments and lie to your neighbors and obfuscate and create counter narratives and cover stories, then you're trained to be on the lookout for being discovered and being outed and being found out. So a lot of our early journey was built around that neurosis. And I've been out of that world and out of that mindset for a long time now. I think in regard to the transparency side of it, coming out of that after my first couple of years, I realized this is destroying me. Living this duplicitous life is going to be the end of me. And I'd rather just hide in plain sight. I'd rather just be open. I'd rather just tell the truth and let the cards fall where they may. So that's been my MO really for the last 12, 13 years, is to just be a lot more transparent and open. And it's generally been, I think, a much healthier way to live. And that's why I write and speak the way I do.
I mean, I think part of what you would be up against is, you know, not only is there a kind of a progressive cancel culture, but there's also a conservative one where if you don't toe the certain kind of line and speak the right language and be overt about the certain type of things, that you're kind of no longer in the crowd.
Totally. And yet, I think there are a lot of us who are hungry for something different. And rather than spend the majority of my time engaging in cancel culture or critiquing cancel culture, I just want to try and live an alternative option and invite others to join us here.
I want to talk a little bit about just the business of what Preemptive Love has done. What I mean by that is, you know, you and I have been friends for a long time. I've been following Preemptive Love for a very long time. And I can forget that, you know, I knew you guys as missionaries in the beginning. And then I remember when heart surgeries were the thing that you were pivoting towards. And when Buy Shoes, Save Lives was a tagline and part of the business model, and saw the iterations of the way that you were providing heart surgeries, from you know, flying in Western doctors to teaching Iraqi doctors and kind of streamlining that process. And then to today, where you are part of, you know, doing micro enterprises and helping internally displaced people and refugees. And I'm just so curious about how you determine when is the time to pivot, and when, if there's a time where you've thought that something is actually like outside of our wheelhouse and it wouldn't be good for us to take this on, or has that ever happened?
Yeah, we say no all the time. I think your analysis is right and fair. We say yes to a lot of things, and we say yes to a lot of things that others would not. And we've allowed ourselves to change. Pivot is the word that we use and seems most appropriate for a couple of these junctures. But we do say no a lot to things that don't fit. Learning how to define that which doesn't fit has been part of the maturing process, particularly learning how to pass on our gut feeling as a leadership team about what doesn't fit. It's one thing for me or Jessica or others on our exec team to say, you know what, that doesn't fit, let's pass. It's another thing to know how to institutionalize that and pass it on to the next generation of leadership, so that 30 years from now, the organization is both entrepreneurial and somehow focused at the same time.
I mean, it almost seems kind of unfair that you got really good, from my vantage point, you got really good at doing the heart surgery thing. Like I said, you kind of... It seems as though you kind of stumbled forward. You just thought there's these people and we need to find a way to help them. And so you did. And I know in the beginning, it was just the only way to do it was expensive, but it streamlined, it got better, it refined. And then you got really good at it, and you solved some real problems. And then all of a sudden, you know, ISIS comes and you've got the pressing problem in Iraq all of a sudden is different than it was. And you've got to say, okay, we just learned how to do this thing really well. And now we've got to start over kind of learning how to do a different thing. Am I assessing that?
Totally. I think sad is how it felt at the time in many ways. Oh, those were hard years all the way around. And, you know, frankly, part of why they were hard is, and I appreciate how it felt from your vantage point, the idea that we got really good at doing heart surgeries, that rings true to me. The caveat, or sort of behind the branding and storytelling of it all, which I think we always told the truth on this, but it can be hard to perceive, is that we were a coalition of doctors and nurses. We didn't hire those surgeons to come in and train. We didn't keep people on staff. It was always kind of a brokered partnership, brokered relationships, short-term contracts that had to be renegotiated month after month after month at times. And I don't know if we ever could. I don't know if hardly anyone could reach a financial size that it would make sense to run what is essentially a global hospital going all over the world, you know, a global sort of university medical system where you're going all over the world training and building up other countries' medical systems. So it was fraught from the beginning, even as it was, I think, very successful. We relied heavily on state money, either Iraqi money or, as we expanded, Libyan government money or Pakistani government money, to bring us in and build up their doctors and nurses and kind of counter the realities of brain drain in conflict-ridden areas. And those things tend to run. There's an inverse relationship between conflict and infrastructural investment. If your country's at conflict, which is where we wanted and found ourselves most drawn, wanted to be working, if your country's at conflict, like Libya, then the state is less likely to invest millions of dollars in work like ours at the time, building up healthcare systems and training nurses and surgeons. So, and yet it's really expensive to move medical teams all over the world and, you know, keep surgeons on modest retainers so they can afford to work with us a little bit for long stretches of time. And yeah, so we were good at it, but the expertise never existed in my hands or my staff's hands. It always existed in a set of like contracted relationships, which made it very difficult to maintain. It was very labor intensive and, you know, very negotiation intensive.
Well, and I wonder if part of that too was preemptive love doing what all good nonprofit NGOs want to do, which is not be needed in the same capacity, meaning
worked ourselves out of a job in many ways. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't in good conscience say we worked ourselves out of the job because we accomplished everything we wanted to accomplish by making the Iraqi surgical system tip top. We improved it. We improved the Libyan surgical system, especially for kids. We've improved the Iranian surgical system for kids, especially nursing care, et cetera. But we did it as brokers. We, like PLC proper, we did it as financiers, we did it as middlemen, logisticians. We didn't do it as the surgical experts ourselves in-house. We had to bring that in from the outside. And that basically meant we were in a middleman role. And so once we put great expert surgeons and nurses in touch and helped finance and keep the cash flowing and the people moving with these other state systems, we became less needed. The other doctors and nurses and the governments were able to kind of cut us out in some ways, and we became an excess cost or a bit of excess baggage in some of this model, I think. And so we worked ourselves out of a job in that way. And our doctor and nurse's friends continue to work with some of these governments to build up their systems without us. And we're cheering them on, and that we want all that success for both sides.
So that leads me to, again, the work that you're currently doing with internally displaced people and refugees. And part of my understanding is that part of why that's something you took on was because that there were not very many organizations there that were connected as Preemptive Love and on the ground in the same way.
Yeah, that's 100% true. When the surgery work was at its best, we were making projections. We felt very reasonable projections that if things continue to go this way in 7 years in some of these hospitals, 5 to 7 years in some of these hospitals, 10 years, we could stop working and they would be stood up on their own 2 feet and rocking along and saving hundreds, maybe thousands of lives a year without us because of the last 5 or 10 years of investment that we made together. And so I started looking down the road 5 or 10 years and saying, what are we going to do? Are we going to totally shutter our doors? Are we going to pivot the heart surgery work to other countries? Are we going to consider ourselves heart surgery for kids experts? Or are we going to look deeper in Iraq and consider ourselves Iraqi experts or Middle Eastern experts and figure out how to leverage this network and our expertise and our travels and our reputation to do other things inside Iraq? We ended up kind of pursuing both trajectories, or, you know, looking at both trajectories simultaneously. And then ISIS came in, oil crashed, which meant all of our state contracts, you know, got screwed up because they didn't have oil money flowing as much anymore. ISIS takes over a third of Iraq, a third of Syria, starts rising up in Libya. Iran gets involved in Iraq militarily. And there were millions of people displaced on the run for their lives. And we were on the front lines of it. We had, you know, after the Iraq war, after President Bush started winding troops down, Obama oversaw the final exit of troops. When the war officially ended and the troops were gone, most of the money, international money, dried up, just like it's dried up now in Syria and Iraq and Libya. So the money dries up, which means most the organizations go home. There's a huge glut of help and interest and aid money when there's a crisis, when there's a boom. And when the troops pull out, the crisis is declared to be over, then the money pulls out, then you get this vacuum, which becomes the very conditions that you need for violence to reemerge and the next crisis to begin. It's as predictable as the sunrise. And we had made Iraq our home. We weren't there for the glut. We weren't there to just get while the getting was good. That was home. That is home for us. I'm sitting in the US right now, but Iraq is home. And then ISIS rises up in our home and we were front lines to it. But because we'd spent the last years traveling all over the country, saving the lives of children, being on evening news, local news, national news, had connections from the prime minister's office through parliament all the way down to local governors and tribal leaders and the local mosque, we had a great reputation and we had access to everyone. And so we decided to stay and take care of our home and take care of our friends and do what the rest of our neighbors were doing, which was figure out how to survive and how to pitch in.
Did you have a moment that you can pinpoint where you thought, I guess we're a relief agency now?
Yeah. Well, it was more of a matter of before we knew what to do. So there was a moment where we were clearly a heart surgery agency, like a small little heart surgery organization. And then ISIS is marauding their way across the country. I'm playing this kind of consultant analyst role for a lot of people back in the US, think tank types and policy advisor types and security types and, you know, various religious leaders. We're still a heart surgery organization. And the more I'm looking at things and digging into details and analyzing and spending all day just doing meta-analysis, I realize we have an opportunity here. This is coming right toward us. The victims, the displaced are coming right toward us. And I circled up our team, which included a number of interns that were with us for that summer in 2014. And we met around our tiny little table. We were three full-time staff, if I recall correctly. Maybe we were four. And I said something to the effect of, this, I think, might end up being one of the most historic moments of our lifetime. And are we going to sit this one out under the premise that we were a small heart surgery organization and we didn't know what to do? Or are we going to throw out the playbook and figure out how to do something new? Admittedly, we don't know how to do emergency relief work. We're not experts, but we do know Iraq and we know our neighborhoods and we know our friends and we have a great network. And we basically had a 3-minute conversation, took a vote, and we were obviously going to get involved. And from that point forward, it was just all hands on deck. No real plan except to love our neighbors as ourselves and see where it took us.
Can I ask some real like boring questions about the relief side?
Yeah.
Because I've always been curious about the logistics. I know that Preemptive Love has provided some, you know, just very like basic stuff like blankets, food, space heaters. Are you getting those things yourself internally from places in Iraq? Are they being sent from other places? How does that work?
Yeah, we only buy local if it can be bought locally. We have refused millions and millions of dollars in gifts in kind. Let me send you free clothes from J. Crew. Let us send you any number of donated goods. And we've said no over and over and over, even though it would have boosted our revenue numbers and made us look like a bigger organization. Our argument has always been to donors, you're going to put our local clothes selling friend Ahmed out of business if we dump $1 million of free clothes into the marketplace. So we buy locally whenever we can. When we can't buy locally, we buy, you know, kind of regionally. But we, as much as possible, if it is available to us, we do not import free goods and dump them into the marketplace because it ruins economies.
So I want to talk to you just about fear. When I was reading the book, which by the way, I stayed up way later than I meant to reading the book because I really couldn't put it down. It kind of reads like a series of connected episodes that you experienced. And so much of those were super scary, to be honest. I mean, and I don't know, I was trying to decide, like, if, would I feel differently if I didn't know you personally, if I was just reading about this person that I didn't know going through some really terrifying things. And I kept thinking, like, you could leave at any time. And you could leave at any time. And I, in my opinion, call what you did a success. You know, like you could take the victory lap now if you wanted to, but you're staying. I feel as though right now, perhaps especially Americans, we've made an idol out of safety and we act a lot of times out of fear. I guess I'm wondering why you don't give in to that more.
Well, I think give in is the right word. It's certainly not the case that I don't feel fear. It's interesting to hear you frame it up this way. It has never occurred. I think I can say it has never occurred to me to quit and take a victory lap. I think never. It has occurred to me to quit, but it's always felt more, and it's only happened a few times, but it has felt more like give up or give in, not like victory lap, justification. I'm going to go bask in the glow of this thing now. I'm so proud of what we've done. I mean, when I stop, I am proud of what we've done, but it's never occurred to me to think about a victory lap. And I think part of the reason, I think that the intersection of these two ideas is that we have set our sights on something more than just provide relief for refugees or create jobs for people on the run. We exist to end war. And to end war, we are trying to build the largest, most diverse community of peacemakers on the planet. And that will arguably not happen in my lifetime. It might if we can leverage, you know, some of the best of online tools and the things that connect us. If Facebook conversations we're having with Facebook were to go all the way in the right positive direction and they were to flip a switch and give us access to 2.3 billion people on their platform at one time, you know, we could find ourselves connected as a global movement of peacemakers in a way that the world has never seen before. But short of that, we may not ever reach to that place in my tenure or in my lifetime. So having set our sights on something as big as working to end war, the idea of a victory lap has never occurred to me. And the idea of giving in to fear, I think, is more easily kept at bay because we have a big, grand vision that is more compelling on most days, in most cases, than the fear itself.
So about this ending war business, I know that you're generally someone who dreams big, but I also know that you're someone who doesn't have time for kind of vague niceties. And I think what I'm getting at is, what would that look like? Like, what is a goalpost along the way to ending war, and how would PLC be a part of that?
Yeah, I appreciate that you think that of me, because that rings true. That's how I might see myself as well. And yet, I think sometimes big ideas, big dreams do require the courage to say something before you fully understand what all the goalposts might be before you say it or dedicate yourself to it. I liken it to, let's say we were standing on the road together and we could look way off in the distance and see this extremely high mountain peak down the road. I don't know how far the human eye can see, but let's say we can see this extremely high mountain way down the road. And in between us, there are a number of other mountains and there are some roads that are carved out for us and we could go on foot or we could go by car. And we just point to the mountain in the far distance and we say, we're headed for that mountain. And your next question before we ever set foot would be, yeah, but how are we going to get there? My response, if we care about that mountain on the horizon, might be, I don't know, but let's just start walking. We'll figure it out on the way. And because we've got this looming vision that is drawing us forward, there are actually probably 100 paths that we could take to get to that place that's 100 miles in the distance. I know if the human eye can't see 100 miles, but let's imagine it's that far away. You know, there's any number of detours and routes we could take as long as we keep our eyes fixed on the big thing that we're going toward. So that's part of the dynamic about how I think about this. To try and be more practical for you, I have lived through war enough to know that war is always a combination of propaganda, power, the weaponization and mobilization of the weaponization of information, the weaponization of ideas, the weaponization of individuals and communities and groups and geography. And there are factors that make some people more vulnerable to weaponization against others than maybe their next door neighbor or their next door neighbor community. And some of what I've experienced and some of which the research supports is that economics and ideology are huge factors in the degree to which we can be weaponized against each other. So one of the reasons that we work to help FAST with relief is because it helps cut off the spread of violence. Violence spreads like a virus. And I've seen it firsthand. When people are being attacked by ISIS, the most natural reaction is to attack back or to turn around to a neighbor and spread ideas that might result in the neighbor attacking back. So it's important to get to ground zero as quickly as possible so that you can stop the spread of violence. Mend the wounds, shore up help for the people who need it most, and try to mitigate the blowback of those early days of violence, or lest it metastasize and spread from one community to another to another. That's true whether the perpetrator is ISIS, or whether it's some state government, whether it's drone warfare, whether it's white terrorists in the US, whether it's gangs in Honduras. Violence begets violence begets violence. Another thing that we know is one of the reasons that we work to provide help that lasts in the form of job creation and workforce development and economic development is because the poorer you are, the more desperate and destitute you are, the fewer options you have, and the easier it is for violence to engulf you and demand that you side with violence. So more economically robust neighborhoods, cities, and countries see less violence. So that's why we put a lot of emphasis on our job creation program. You called it micro business, micro enterprise, and that's part of what we do. We also do larger workforce development things where we're building infrastructure that could provide jobs for thousands of people, working with state governments and provincial governments and national governments to work on entire workforce development type ideas. Because we know that the more economically robust countries are, the more shielded they are against violence. And then the third thing would be what we just broadly call our community work, or what others might call peacemaking. We work to change the ideas that lead to war, so that we are less propagandized and less mobilized against our neighbor, because we actually know our neighbor. We actually have robust, interconnected life with people who are different than us. But that takes effort. We most naturally self-sort and self-select into sameness, into likeness, into things that we feel comfortable with. And so somebody has to go out and make intentional efforts toward integration, toward diversity, toward equality. And those would be the kinds of markers that we are looking toward as we work to end war.
It seems as though when people are taken care of, when they have what they need, that's fertile ground for peace. But when those things are taken away, that's when people become tribal and kind of start to see things as a zero-sum game. And so preventing those types of atmospheres is a way to prevent an end war.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, on the way from inequality to equality, even in some of the best of circumstances, you're still at risk of violence. And that's some of what we're seeing in the US right now. Inequality means there are a lot of us who have greater opportunities, greater things afforded to us than others. There are people who get a pass in the United States, and this is true all over the world. There are people who get a pass because of the way they look, the way they pray, the way that they are considered the normal ones, whereas other people are considered abnormal or not from here or too weird. too different. And those things that are considered most normal, or those people who are considered most normal or native in a way, tend to have power and opportunity and money and heritage and legacy accrued to us in ways that others don't. So even if reforms were happening, even if leadership was happening, even if other people start rising or winning, as appeared to be the case for many under the Obama administration, it can still lead to those who are in power, those who have had the most afforded to them for the most amount of time, it can still lead to a sense of loss. And that loss is not untrue. It's not unfounded. It's not crazy that white, moneyed, landed men and others who are kind of in the orbit of that would feel like they are losing out as others rise. And so you get that anxiety and that sense of like, there's not enough to go around and now I'm getting stuff taken away from me. It still can lead to conflict. And our thesis, our conviction really, is that ideas and policy and rhetorical arguments alone are not enough. Podcasts are not enough for me to say into your ears right now anything that I'm saying. What we need are relationships. What we need are a sense of proximity and vulnerability and empathy with people who are different than us. Let me speak as a white, male, Christian, heterosexual, cisgender guy. I need to know any number of people who are different than me. I am impoverished. However rich and powerful I am actually impoverished without Black friends, Latino friends, Asian friends, queer friends, Muslim friends, Hindu friends in my life telling me what it's like to be them and to live in their skin, to live their reality in the United States today or in the world today. It's empathy and relationships that helps me release my grip on power and the opportunities most naturally afforded to me and my privilege and my past that I get in this world. That's what helps me release and be more willing to create a world with them where we might come closer to standing on equal ground. Rhetorical arguments alone, I don't think, are going to get us there.
I mean, the term that comes to mind as you're talking is a scarcity mindset, mm-hmm. where if you gain some modicum of safety, that takes the safety away from me. Or if you gain some kind of equality, that takes away from me. That's the thing, as I see the landscape of, you know, here in my context in Texas with immigrants, that people are afraid yeah. that if people come in and if they're granted some type of safety, that automatically takes safety away from me. It's a scarcity mindset versus an abundance mindset that says there's going to be enough for all of us.
100%.
You had a chapter about your kids, and this kind of brings me back to the safety thing. I wonder how you processed the ideas of risk that you take for yourself versus risks that you take for your children. And there's kind of an idea, I think it's somewhat natural, but I think it's also very American as well, that risking for our kids isn't something we should do. And I know that you've had to think deeply about that.
Yeah. Every one of us would likely agree that our role as parents is, I mean, there's a number of ways we could say it. every one of us, including me and Jessica and me, I would agree that one of our jobs, roles as parents, is to protect our kids. Another true thing that we would all likely agree on is that it is our job as parents to develop our kids, to grow our kids, to help them be the most well-formed, informed, contributing, loving, successful members of society that we can. I wonder if we don't explore enough the dynamics between those things. I wonder if at times there's actually an inverse relationship, a sort of dispositive relationship between protection and development. Or in the very least, protection can go too far. We all know that in theory. We all know and would nod along if I framed it in kind of pejorative terms, like if I said sheltering our kids or I talked about helicopter parenting, like none of us want to be associated with those kind of pejorative terms. So I think we're generally aware of the idea that it is our job to push our kids into discomfort. It is our job to expose them to things that stretch them. So I think that's just at the heart of what Jess and I are exploring is how like Shane and Kate, how do we develop our kids in ways that make them healthy, whole, contributing members of society? And part of our path has just led us to believe that that our kids can handle maybe more than we might be initially inclined to allow them to experience and see. And look, not for nothing. It's as you've read in the book, and as others are commenting and sending me DMs and raising their hands on tour and asking me in the private rooms, like it has come at a cost. And I wouldn't dare say that we've gotten it perfect or that our kids have not experienced significant pain in this life and in this work that we've chosen to be a part of. But I think what we're trying to pursue is how do we help our kids relate to pain in ways that are integrated, integral? How do they come to know pain in a healthy way that's just a part of life rather than fear pain and withdraw from pain and assume that that's the way to live your life? How do we create and grow, develop our kids so that fear is not the greatest, or sorry, death is not the greatest thing to fear in their life, but they have a more healthy relationship with death. They know that death is inevitable. And so how then shall we live our lives while constantly in the glow and the shadow of death?
So just lastly, you know, you mentioned you're doing this tour and they're in living rooms and you're talking with people and you're spending a lot of time listening. And, you know, these are mostly young American people. You're listening to where their fears are and what's going on with them. And I think that's one of the things I appreciate about Preemptive Love is I really do see it as a movement. And the mantra of love anyway is so much more than marketing. And I wonder if you could help us, those of us who perhaps after reading the book, our life seems a little more mundane. We're here in maybe urban areas, but maybe we're in a suburb or maybe we're in a small town. And it's hard for us to see how the mantra love anyway would apply to us, how peacemaking, we often don't have an imagination for what peacemaking would look like in our context.
Oh man, I love that. Yeah, I think the one of my biggest concerns, anxieties, fear might be an appropriate word, about our work, marketing in general, storytelling, the book, the film, the culture that we've created, influencer type culture that we have, is that it can give the sense that what the world needs is more professional peacemakers. That if you just pack up your family and move to Iraq and start an organization as a white person, American, coming in to save the day, then everything will be better, which then inevitably leads 99.9% of people to go, well, I'm not going to do that, or I couldn't do that, or I could never be like that. And then we sort of perpetuate these narratives of what are essentially hero narratives. They're well-intentioned. I'm the beneficiary in a way of those dynamics, but we take ourselves, it's a kind of quote unquote inspiration that takes us out of the game. It's like going to see Hamilton and saying, oh, I could, that was so amazing. It was mind blowing. I could never sing like that. We sit in the seats and we applaud, and we are moved and we are inspired, but we don't imagine ourselves as being the actual actors and players in the game, in the work. And that's one of my biggest fears about being a communicator, about being a marketer, about being a quote unquote leader, is that I would be seen or propped up as the avatar to carry the concerns and anxieties of the community rather than one of us among whom we all together get to work together. So to bring it down to the everyday, I mean, what looks to the person in the living room where we're traveling right now, to the person on the other side of the screen watching the film, or the person holding the book in their hands, what can look like an exotic, foreign, intrepid adventure story, in many ways, for Jess and me, for the last 11 or so of the 12 years that we've lived in Iraq, for the last 15 years or so that we've lived overseas, it's mostly felt like loving our neighbors, choosing a home, choosing a place to live like you did, and doing what needs to be done in our neighborhood. That's our story. That's another really valid way to understand our story, is that we chose a neighborhood and we chose it with intention. We chose it because it had needs. We chose it because it would stretch us. We chose it because it might put our lives in harm's way so that we could be a part of lifting up and benefiting others. We chose it so that we could speak to power. We chose it so that we could leverage our privilege and opportunity to the benefit of others. But after making that choice, it's just home. It's just our neighborhood. It's just the place we live. And then organizationally, we've worked to institutionalize that so that our organization and our movement, we make our home in more and more communities across the world. So we're doing it again across Syria. We're doing it again across Mexico. We're working to do it in North Korea. We keep trying to make our home so that we can love our neighbors in new frontlines places. So I think the message to everyone is, how can we live and love on the front lines where we live, where we are?
You know, that's something that I did notice in the book. I think a lot of people think of the work of PLC as like sending, you know, convoys of trucks across the country, or, you know, other countries or whatever. And, you know, absolutely they do that. But part of, you know, part of the initiative with PLC making soap started with some people that sound like live just like down the street from you guys, like in your neighborhood. These Yazidi refugees are exactly. internally displaced. Yeah. Yeah. That's so good, Jeremy. Jeremy, I love you, brother, and I love your family, and I'm so thankful for you and for your posture in the world. And I've learned so much from you through the years. What do you want? Like, please plug something for me right now. Like, what do you, I know that, obviously people should see the film. They should read the book. There's also these dinners. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, in as much as we're trying to give people tools to find our way out of our own relational poverty, out of all the things that are tearing us apart, we have created a lot of things under this Love Anyway sort of brand that we mean to be tools. So we've created the Love Anyway film to help people, particularly privileged and more power, people in power, to provoke conversations about racism and bigotry and how we can find our ways, you know, through that and back to one another and to more healthy spaces. Also at loveanyway.com, you can find information about what we're calling Love Anyway Feast. This is just a one night sort of tool that we're giving you so that you can invite people over and say, hey, we may not know each other. We've lived in this neighborhood for a long time together, or I just moved in, or I haven't crossed the office to speak to you in your cubicle in a while, but I just wanted to invite you to this Love Anyway Feast, because we're a little bit different on this metric or this marker, but I know you and I both want to be the kind of people who pursue love anyway. So come join me for this Love Anyway Feast. We're kind of rallying around November 3rd, but people are doing it all around that week. We're trying to see if we can get some momentum globally in and around November 3rd. But it's going to be a tool that is just there for people to kind of anchor around and see if we can invite people in and start new relationships and start new friendships around this theme that, yeah, we're different, but we can love anyway. The last thing I'd say is all of this work we've discussed, from the concrete, very easy to understand dynamics of how we show up when bombs are still falling and help stop the bleeding, to the big job creation kind of work that we're doing to create economic development, to the philosophical stuff that we've discussed here about peacemaking and diversity and bigotry and bias. All of that is fueled by a community of monthly donors, and none of our work has happened, and none of it will be able to continue to happen if we don't have monthly donors supporting us week in, week out, month after month. So I would just strongly encourage anyone and everyone, if this has been helpful to you, if you think it will be helpful to others, and if you believe in the work that we're doing and the philosophy that I've kind of laid out here, please consider going to loveanyway.com and signing up to be a monthly donor. $5 a month, $500 a month, it all adds up to make such a huge difference in our life. And one of the things that we're experiencing right now is that it is a lot easier to raise money when bombs are falling. Everyone understands that, and everyone was willing years ago to throw money at us so that we could provide a bag of flour. But that money's gone now, and a lot of our collective interest is gone now. And as I laid out much earlier in this podcast, we are moving into that sort of vacuum era when the violence starts to reemerge. There are huge protests and violence emerging across Iraq right now. And one of the reasons is because lack of economic development, lack of peacemaking initiatives, and the vacuum that was created still hasn't been rightly addressed and filled. And I have grave concerns about similar dynamics happening in the United States right now with regard to immigration, racism, institutional kind of stuff. And we are giving significant amount of time and resource and effort to help address that in the United States and Mexico along the migrant route as well. So that would be my strongest single request is help us sustain this work by joining us as a monthly donor at loveanyway.com/give.
So loveanyway.com is pretty easy to remember, but I'll be sure to put links to all this on the show notes for this show, for this episode, so people can link there. Jeremy, man, thanks so much for being on the show again.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. Always love getting time with you.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. But